From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Biracial Americans are often expected to choose a racial identity, black or white. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about race and identity with three people who are the offspring of racially mixed marriages. One of them, Lisa Funderburg, is the author of the new book, Black, White, Other. Also, how does Ben & Jerry's come up with new ice cream flavors? We talk with the company's former CEO, Chico Lager, about building a gourmet ice cream business and trying to give it a social conscience. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg comments on cyberspeak. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Four Navy ships are headed for Haitian waters. They're carrying 2,000 Marines who will be prepared to evacuate American citizens if that becomes necessary. The move comes as the Clinton administration is warning Haiti's military leaders they'll have to step down or face possible military action. Meanwhile, the Coast Guard says it's already picked up 247 Haitians. That means more than 13,000 Haitian boat people have been picked up in the last 12 days. An international human rights monitoring group has suspended its Haitian operation. The group cites increasing political tension with the country's military rulers. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
A joint United Nations Organization of American States human rights mission has temporarily ceased its operations after Haiti's military regime told officials that their presence in the country was illegal. A UN source said that two offices with more than 50 people were closed after Haiti's Foreign Affairs Ministry requested a halt in human rights activities. The UN OAS mission has been documenting increasing reports of political repression in Haiti, including murder and rape allegedly committed by government security forces and supporters of the military regime. Haiti's military rulers have escalated their rhetoric against foreigners in recent days in response to tightened international economic sanctions. Meanwhile, William Gray, President Clinton's special advisor on Haiti, warned Haiti's military rulers to step down within 6 months or face possible military action. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
President Clinton says the United States will send $50 million to the Baltic nations to promote private industry. Mr. Clinton began the first part of a European trip today by visiting Latvia. He met with Latvian, Lithuanian, and Estonian leaders. The president says he understands those three countries' difficulty in their transition from Soviet rule.
From our own history, Americans know that winning the fight for independence is followed by even more arduous and difficult struggles for economic stability and national security. The people of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania have hard work ahead. But our meeting today convinces me that that work can and will be done successfully.
Mr. Clinton also says he's confident that Russia will keep its promise to remove all of its remaining troops from the Baltics on schedule. The Federal Reserve has ended a two-day policy session without announcing any change in interest rates. Analysts had widely expected the central bank to leave the rates unchanged. The bank has boosted short-term rates four times this year in an effort to fend off inflation and keep the economy expanding. There's been speculation the Fed might raise rates to help defend the U.S. dollar, which has taken a beating against foreign currencies recently. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 21 points at 3,677. The Nasdaq Composite Index has fallen more than 2 points to 701. This is NPR. The four regional Bell telephone systems have asked a federal district court to let them compete head-to-head. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has this report.
The lawyer for the four Bell companies, Peter Huber, said the bottom line is that AT&T and other long-distance providers are charging too much. And he said if the so-called baby bells can get into the market, that will change.
The idea is to push down long-distance prices, which are too high today, significantly too high.
The bells say long-distance costs up to 50% too much. They also want permission to make telephones and telecommunications equipment, a multi-billion dollar market from which they were barred by the 1982 court ruling that broke up AT&T. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
Federal car safety investigators have stepped up their investigation of Jeep Grand Cherokees for possible failure of its gas lines. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is checking the failure rate of connections between fuel lines that may cause gas to spray in the engine compartment. The agency says 21 fires have been reported among 1993 and 94 model Grand Cherokees with a V8 engine. The remnants of Tropical Storm Alberto are still wreaking havoc in Georgia. State Highway Patrol officers have closed all roads into Sumter County because of flooding. Four radio stations in Americus, the county seat, are off the air because of flooding and power outages. Flooding has shut down two water treatment plants in Clayton County. Officials there are asking the 200,000 residents to conserve water. It's wildfires in seven western states. Two of these states have fires either contained or under control. Firefighters had expected to control two of the largest blazes in Utah sparked by lightning over the weekend, but a crew of 200 firefighters was forced to retreat. The National Guard is on standby and could be called in later today. Winds and weather temperatures have made it very hard for firefighters to control blazes. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Interracial couples are often warned about the consequences their children will face. Common wisdom has it they will grow up between two polarized racial worlds and feel at home in neither. Lisa Funderburg is the child of a black father and white mother. She wanted to talk with other adult children of interracial parents about race and identity. The result is her new book, Black, White, Other. We invited her along with two of the people interviewed in the book. Debo Adegbile is a 25-year-old law student living in New York. Zenobia Kujichagulia is the executive director of an emergency services center for poor and homeless people. She's 43 and lives in Oakland. Lisa Funderburg is a journalist in her mid-30s, living in New York. I asked her if her new book developed out of conflicts she faced.
I suppose I felt sometimes a conflict between how the world saw me and how I saw myself, and that would be the most essential conflict that I've ever had about issues of racial identity.
What's the difference between how the world saw you and how you saw yourself?
In its most reductionist terms, the world sees me as a white person, and I see myself as a combination of my white family and my black family.
Does the world see you as a white person because you're light-skinned?
Yes, I'm very fair-skinned, and I have straight hair, and I have blue eyes. And that fits most people's criterion of whiteness.
Now tell us about your parents.
My father is from Georgia, and he is a fair-skinned black man. And my mother is from Chicago, and she is a white woman. And they met in Philadelphia and married, and my sisters and I were raised there. And that's their background.
Debo, tell us something about your parents.
Okay. My mom came to this country from Dublin in the 1950s, late 1950s or middle 50s. And my dad came over a couple of years later from Lagos, Nigeria. Both parents came to New York City, and my mom was looking for work, and my dad was looking to go to school here in the United States. And they ended up meeting in New York while my mom was working here and my dad was going to school at that time.
Now, since we can't see what you look like, would you describe, you know, like the shade of your skin and what your
sure.
hair is like and how that affects how other people see you?
Sure. Well, my skin is pretty brown. Oftentimes in New York City anyway, people begin speaking to me in Spanish and... Unfortunately, Spanish was not one of my strongest subjects in school, so I can't often respond, but I have pretty straight black hair, which I attribute to my mother's genes, but I have many of my dad's facial features. I have a wide nose and full lips.
Now, how do you identify when people ask you your race, what are you likely to say?
Well, I always say the same thing, and I kind of take it from there. I say that I'm an Irish Nigerian, and over the years that's had a lot of shock value, as you might imagine. but I sort of throw that out from the outset, and then depending on where the conversation goes from there, I react accordingly.
Not a real big Irish Nigerian community.
No, I don't think there are a whole lot of us. My brother and I, and anybody else that is looking to start a club can give me a call.
Now, your parents divorced when you were 10.
Yes.
And your father went back to Nigeria, and you grew up from then on with your mother. So when your parents split up, did that affect how you saw yourself racially?
Actually, it didn't. And I attribute that in large part to my mother, because even though the divorce was difficult for all of us, as divorces tend to be, my mother never attempted to recraft our identities. And when I say our, I speak about my younger brother and myself, Remy. She was always very much, both my parents, while they were married, instilled the fact in both of us that we were both Irish and Nigerian, and that was a special positive thing, as opposed to something to be shy about or embarrassed about. And my mother never reconsidered her initial position.
Zenobia, tell us something about your parents.
Well, listening to the first two just reminds me of how alike and yet very different we all are. My parents sort of resemble what Lisa described in a sense, at least physically. My mother is white. She was a farm girl and came from a family where the father, my grandfather, was Swiss German, and my grandmother was very British Irish. My father is family was black and Native American, and some white. And the Native American was Cherokee. My father is very, very light skinned. In fact, my father and all of his siblings grew up to all pass for white.
Would you describe the shade of your skin and what people assume you are when they meet you?
Well, it depends on where I am. That's one of the reasons I live in the Bay Area, that there seems, especially as I'm older now, to be less misunderstanding. But I'm very light-skinned. I have features that, depending on where you are often mistaken for being white. my hair is pretty fine, and it's curly, wavy, and I generally do my best to keep it from being straight. I'm often mistaken for being white, more so when I was younger than I am now. But depending on where I am, it still can happen.
And how do you identify yourself racially?
When I was younger, much younger, as a child, I always identified myself as sort of all of the things my mother told me I was, and I thought that was really wonderful. That got me into a lot of trouble because I didn't realize when I was quite young that it was wonderful, but it was supposed to be a secret, at least the part of color was. And as soon as I got out of my family of origins home, then I exclusively identified as black, which always created problems because I didn't fit most people's appearance of that. Now I pretty much identify as a black Cherokee woman whose mother is white. And that way I'm acknowledging it. I just don't feel it.
You don't feel white?
No.
Oh, and why? I mean, growing up with a mother who was white, why do you not feel that you're part white?
I think there are a lot of reasons, but I think it's at this point, what I'm identifying is primarily cultural and social and experiential and political. I mean, clearly it's there biologically. It's just that who I am in terms of the life I lead and the daily struggles that I deal with, I don't live the life of a white person, and I really don't identify with it.
I'd like to ask each of you if both sides of your family were loving of you, or if there was any racism directed at you from either side.
I don't think that I experienced any racism from my family. It was actually interesting for me when I was a young boy, about six or so, my family took trips in two consecutive summers, first to Ireland, and then actually first to Nigeria and then to Ireland. And we were very well received by both sides of the family. And that was a very special time for me, having my extended family be so far away. I didn't get to see them very often, and it was quite a treat to get to see everybody. And both families accepted me and the husband or wife, depending, with open arms, and that was very special. And I think that is something that informed my opinions of race as well. And it did so by letting me know that race is something that Americans are peculiarly absorbed with. And I haven't felt the same type of forces from my Irish and Nigerian family. Though, of course, when you get Irish and Nigerian people coming to the United States, they may or may not become infected with Americans' preoccupation.
That's an interesting perception. Lisa, what about you?
Well, there are stories that I have found, and it's interesting because I didn't know these until I started working on the book. I think one of the things that was compelling for me was to find out more, not just about how other people related to having this background, but also to find out more about my own family, because we really didn't talk about the identity of me and my two older sisters when I was growing up. And so I was doing a lot of interviewing of my parents for some deep background for this. And my mother told me some stories about how there was certainly a period of adjustment that had to happen on her side of the family. Her parents had lived in pretty much completely white communities growing up and were concerned and had concerns for her when she told them that she was going to marry a black man. And apparently my grandfather, my mother's father, said in response, I want to crawl inside a hole. And he obviously had some difficulty with it, but also my mother told me that within the next 4 years, for as long as he continued to be alive, he came around to accept and even like my father, and that was because he got to know who my father was and realized that, for one thing, they both held they had the same work ethic, which was a very important thing to my grandfather and very important to my father. And that was something that certainly crossed all the boundaries of fear and territoriality and just any kind of bigotry that there might have been.
Zenobia, what about your story?
Well, I think it's interesting that the three of us had pretty good experiences with both sides of our family. I did, in a sense, because I know a lot of people didn't.
Right.
Except the ironic thing with me, I guess, is that, first of all, like Lisa, it wasn't discussed much. And what was discussed was just about completely with my mother and myself, and it was you're this wonderful bouquet of flowers kind of thing, but it was also don't tell anybody. My mother's side of the family, which as I said is very white, were very, very, very accepting of my brother and sister and I, and they were very good to us, and whatever they may have thought inside, which I suspect would have been mostly just unknown things, just they didn't know. They kept to themselves, and they did their best to make us feel good about ourselves. They really didn't know what they were dealing with, though, because where they lived, where they grew up, there were very, very few black people at all, and so it wasn't something they knew anything about. My mother didn't know my father was black until after she married him, and they certainly didn't know it either. My father's side of the family, on the other hand, simply never, ever, ever discussed it and did their best to pretend that it didn't exist. And it was only when I was quite small that my father's mother ever talked to me about the Cherokee stuff, being born on the reservation and life there. Later, she denied everything. Family pictures that existed when I was little disappeared as I got older. There were no pictures anywhere of family members. So I guess there were these incredible mixed messages, and they were very insidious in that they were covert.
So, Zenobia, I think it's interesting, when you were a young woman, I guess, you moved to the San Francisco area and were taken in by your father's side of the family, but the side of his family that was black and identified as black, as opposed
That's
to your
right.
father and his siblings who identified as white.
That's
so
right.
how did that change your sense of self to live with a part of your family that was black and was public about it?
It was validating. For the first time in my life, I did not feel isolated. I did not feel alienated. The best years of my childhood were on my mother's parents' farm, and they were wonderful, but I always felt like I had been beamed down from a spaceship, and I kept waiting for someone to come and get me. And I didn't know how to articulate it. I didn't know how to really process it mentally or emotionally. But when I found my relatives out here, it was like being whole. It sounds so cliche, I guess, but it was. It was like, this is who I am. This is real.
We're talking about race and identity with three people who each had one black and one white parent. Lisa Funderburg is the author of a new book about biracial Americans called Black, White, Other. Debo Adegbile and Zenobia Kujichagulia are both interviewed in the book. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about race and identity with three biracial Americans.
This is a kind of complicated question, but, you know, in American society, racially, the way it's worked is that, you know, white people have often been the oppressors of black people. And I wonder if that comes into play in your own personal identity, if there's any, if the white part feels more like the oppressor part, or something politically that you don't really want to accept or deal with because of, you know, certain historical truths in America.
Well, I would say that I don't feel that there are these two little parts of me battling each other out inside, but I am more and more comfortable with not having to answer the question, what is your racial identity? And I think in some ways, working on the book and listening to all the 46 people who talked to me for it, mm-hmm. Talk about the individuality of their experience. I think that and their individual definitions of what race meant, all of which were valid to them, but not necessarily valid for the next person who appeared on the next page. I feel less inclined to have to answer that question. However, to be honest, I would have to also add that if I were forced and to fill out a form that said black, white, or other, and I couldn't check other, and I couldn't check all of them, I would not check white. And that, for me, I think is an expression of a political preference of affiliation. If I'm going to have to choose, I would prefer to be affiliated and to show that I have no resistance or reluctance to be associated with blackness.
Lisa, there's somebody in your book who, in the interview, says that I think she'd moved to a black neighborhood from a mixed neighborhood or a mostly white neighborhood, mm-hmm. and when she got there, she realized that there was just like a lot of distrust of white people, and that white people were seen as the oppressors and seen as being bad, and it just made her very uncomfortable and made her think, well, is my mother who's white bad? Is the white part of me bad? What does that mean? And I guess I'm wondering if any of you ever went through something similar.
Well, yes. And that's where, again, we're all really different. It's absolutely true that my preference, for the reasons you've identified, would be if I could just say and be left alone that I'm black, I probably would have just stayed that way. But the world wouldn't let it be. And I, based on my own experiences that I had in the South as a child and then coming of age as I did as a militant in the 60s, I absolutely went through the whole thing of really wishing that I didn't have what Malcolm called the white racist rapist blood in me. I absolutely went through that. And I tried to convince myself to join the Nation of Islam and went to the mosque and listened to them talk about white devils. And I ultimately couldn't do it. But yes, that's been an issue for me personally, very much so.
Ashley Zenobia, you tell a story in the book about when you went to one of the Nation of Islam mosques and you had to take off the covering from your head so they could examine your hair and see if you were really black. They weren't really sure that you were black, and they tried to test you in various ways to examine you.
They did, right. I went with my cousin, and they looked at my hair and looked all around the circle of my cuticles and all these supposed little things and deemed me black enough to enter.
How did that make you feel?
Terrible. Terrible, because it's like no matter what, I felt as though I wasn't acceptable. I wasn't enough of anything. And I had always felt that way. Again, though, each of us come from different families, and in my family, the whole issue of denial played heavily into a lack of self-esteem and having to keep a secret about something on one hand that was supposed to be so wonderful and on the other hand so horrible that you weren't supposed to tell anybody.
Lisa, I want to wrap up with a couple of questions for you, since you interviewed so many people for the book and you got this wide perspective from doing the book. What does race mean to you now? I mean, you asked this question in the book. Is race a function of the color of your skin, or does it have to do with culture, with class, with neighborhood, with the texture of your hair? What is it?
I think the answer I found was that it's all of those things. It's all of those things and twice as many more. And that for me, it was important, it was very valuable that the stories of the people who are in the book concretize that it is all of these parts of you. It's not just the color of your skin. It's not just who your parents were or what their attitudes were or what time you grew up in. It's all of those things. And I think it is really valuable for all of us to look at all those things in conjunction with each other rather than trying to isolate out any particular piece of them. I also think that race is something that has no universal concrete meaning. I personally believe that a lot of the idea of race is a constructed idea that at its very basis is a false notion. However, I simultaneously believe that the impact and effects of racism are as concrete as anything could ever be. And I additionally believe that race for pretty much everybody in the book was a very important and personalized notion, whether it was in some portion determined or in large part determined by exterior pressures, what other people tested or challenged or provided as models of what each person's racial identity should be, or whether it was from an internal, more of an internal definition. I do think that it's a really important, valuable, valid on an individual level concept for some people, and that's to be respected, but not to be lumped together unless people want to lump it together.
We're regrettably out of time. I want to thank the three of you. It's really been fascinating. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Lisa Funderburg is the author of the new book, Black, White, Other. My other two guests, Debo Adegbile and Zenobia Kujichagulia, are both interviewed in the book. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, an executive who ate a lot of ice cream on the job. We talk with Chico Lager, former CEO of Ben & Jerry's. His new book, Ben & Jerry's The Inside Scoop, is a history of the company, covering everything from new flavors to personnel policies. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about the connection between cyberspeak and the so-called technological revolution, and how that compares to the language of other revolutions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has visited Latvia today, the first American president ever to do so. He met with the presidents of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania and pledged to support the pullout of Russian troops from their soil. He's also promised aid to the fledgling democracies. The BBC's Jeremy Harris reports.
With negotiations dragging on over the withdrawal of Russian forces, Mr. Clinton has become a go-between in a dispute that remains a major source of tension between the Baltic states and Moscow. After talks with Baltic leaders here, Mr. Clinton described the remaining differences as narrow. He believed they could still be resolved by the target date of the end of next month. President Yeltsin has linked a military withdrawal to alleged discrimination against the Russian minority in the region, linkage rejected by Washington. Mr. Clinton will take up the issue personally with President Yeltsin when the two men meet this weekend. They discussed it on the phone yesterday. Mr. Clinton knows he's treading a fine line between supporting Baltic demands and offending the Russians.
Jeremy Harris reporting. President Clinton is now in Poland. Investigators checking human radiation experiments say they have evidence of a possible government cover-up. A letter from a U.S. Atomic Energy Commission spokesman specifically denies agency involvement in any human radiation experiments. The letter, dated in December 1950, is addressed to the Associated Press after the AP reported voluntary radiation experiments on 12 Arizona State prisoners. An investigator says the official who wrote the letter may not have known about the tests, but he says a 1947 memo orders staffers to avoid public backlash about the tests. The presidential investigators are holding a meeting today in Washington. A final report is expected next year. Flooding from Tropical Storm Alberto has caused intense problems for Georgia. There's a water crisis in Macon because the city's filtering plant is flooded. The City of America says it got 21 inches of rain in a 24-hour period that ended this morning. Many residents have had to be evacuated. Ken Davis is a spokesman for Georgia's Emergency Management Agency. He says some evacuees are staying in shelters for now.
Not a great number of people have been placed in the public shelters. Many of them have been taken in by friends, neighbors, and relatives. It's just that the ones who have been displaced, many of them have not been able to return to their homes and probably won't be until the waters recede.
The heavy rains are also pouring on Florida and Alabama. The Alabama National Guard has provided authorities with four-wheel drives and opened some of their armories for use. Stocks closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 22 points to end the day at 3,674. This is NPR News. PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat has met with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin today in Paris. The leaders discussed expanding Palestinian self-rule. The men are in France, along with Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, to receive a United Nations Peace Prize. Lynn Terry reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said the three leaders talked about how to resolve the remaining issues from the Gaza-Jericho Accord, namely the problem of refugees and extending more authority to the Palestinians. Arafat called on the Israelis to release more Palestinian prisoners, especially women. This issue is preventing his reconciliation with Islamic militants. Yitzhak Rabin said Israel is committed to bringing an end to the 100-year conflict between the Palestinians, the Jewish community, and Israel. But he said the two sides have to be patient. Arafat wants to speed up the peace process. He promised to hold democratic elections as soon as possible, but he didn't give a date. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
A four-ship Navy task force is sailing today for Haiti. A Pentagon spokesman says the assault group has stopped to pick up some 2,000 Marines in North Carolina. They are trained for emergency evacuations. The force is expected to arrive in Haitian waters later this week. The Pentagon says this will put a robust amount of military force in the region, enough to deal with almost anything. President Clinton's special advisor on Haiti says there's no imminent invasion being planned, but advisor William Gray defines imminent as meaning in the next several days. The Federal Reserve has ended a two-day policy meeting today without announcing any changes in interest rates. Analysts had widely expected the Fed's policymaking committee to leave interest rates alone. The Fed has boosted interest rates four times this year in an effort to hold down inflation. There's been worry the bank would increase rates in an effort to support the sagging dollar. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ben & Jerry's is famous for two things: its upscale ice cream with playful flavors, and its attempt to bring so-called 60s values into the business world. My guest, Fred Chico Lager, is the former CEO of the company. His new book, Ben & Jerry's, The Inside Scoop, is a history of the company, which began in 1978 as a homemade ice cream parlor in an abandoned gas station in Burlington, Vermont. It's now a $100 million publicly held company. Chico Lager was hired as the company's general manager in 1982 and became CEO in 89. He resigned in 91, but remains on the board of directors. Before coming to Ben & Jerry's, he ran a bar in Vermont.
My bar was right around the corner from the original gas station where Ben & Jerry first started making ice cream. And we had something of a free trade agreement. I would go up there for ice cream and they'd come down to my place for beer and to listen to music.
And they asked you to do what afterwards?
Well, it was at a time when the business was growing. It was about $1 million in sales, and they needed somebody who had a little more business experience to help them manage what was becoming a pretty big venture. So they asked me to come on board, and I joined the company as the general manager.
Before we get into some of the business and management controversies that you write about in your book, I want to talk a little bit about ice cream. How have you guys come up with new flavors? What's the process for it?
Well, there's a lot of different processes. Some are developed by Ben. You know, he would probably be the number one creative person within the company for flavor development. We now also have a staff of people who work on flavor development. A lot come from ideas that customers suggest to us. Cherry Garcia was a suggestion from a customer. Chunky Monkey was another one that was suggested by a customer. So through a variety of sources.
You say that Ben has sinus problems, and since he was the chief taster, everything had to be really zetzed up, very flavorful in order to pass his tests.
It's true. It's pretty unusual that the chief ice cream taster in a business would have a problem discerning between different flavors, but he really couldn't tell the difference between subtle flavor variations. So going back to the earliest days in the gas station, he would have Jerry put massive doses of flavorings in the ice cream. And then, of course, they added the large chunks to give the ice cream a texture variation so that Ben could react to that.
He liked texture.
He liked texture. He liked those big chunks.
What have been some of the most successful flavors and some of the biggest failures?
Well, I'll start with the failures. Those are always tend to be a little more fun. Lemon peppermint carob chip was one that was made at the gas station once.
And just once.
Just once. There was a honey raisin walnut Oreo that was made just once. I think Jerry maintains that the Oreos were a mistake, but that didn't work out. We had a flavor called sugar plum, which actually made it into pints. But didn't really sell well. And there was a flavor called Fred and Ginger, which was ginger-flavored ice cream with chocolate chunks in the shape of bow ties in honor of Fred Astaire. And the marketing director who thought that up thought it would sell really well in Chinese restaurants because of the ginger flavor. And that one bombed, too.
Hmm. And the most successful ones?
Well, cookie dough, I think, is probably the first one that comes to mind. Chocolate chip cookie dough, which we released in 1991. Phenomenal success. You know, it was the first flavor to displace Heath Bar Crunch as the number one seller. And, you know, certainly flavors like Cherry Garcia, New York Super Fudge Chunk have been very, very popular over time.
As you say in your book, Ben & Jerry's is known for bringing, you know, quote, 60s values to business. Well, you know, in 60s values, no one really likes to be the boss. No one wants to be the authority. Everybody wants to be in a group that's very democratic and where things are talked over. That seems to me like one of the first issues you'd really have to work out in a company.
It is. And, you know, Ben is not someone who likes to sit around in a big group and really make decisions. You know, one of the interesting things about Ben, you know, he's a very creative, visionary person, but he tends to manage in a fairly autocratic way, and he would be the first one to tell you that. He doesn't really work well in groups. He doesn't really work well in a situation where groups are making decisions.
So his management style was really in a way at odds with the, quote, 60s values.
To some extent it is. And we were most successful when we were able to really work through other people and kind of, you know, try and keep Ben away from that, try and capture what he really brought to the business, but not have him really be involved so much in the day-to-day management of the company.
At some point, you realized that there was a real disparity between the reality of what it was like to work at Ben & Jerry's and the perception of the outside world. What was the perception? What was the reality?
Well, everybody who works for the company will tell you that the perception exceeds the reality. You know, the perception is that the company is a wonderful and joyful place to work. And it is, in some ways, that's true. But the reality is that the company grew extremely quickly, doubling in size for a number of years in a row, 5 or 6 years in a row we doubled in size, adding a large number of employees. And that period of rapid growth put a lot of pressure and strain on the organization and on the people there. And people were working extremely hard, extremely long hours. They would probably tell you that it was the best job that they ever had, but it was not nirvana where people were just, you know, putting their feet up on their desk and things were happening by magic. It took an incredible amount of hard work and dedication on the part of a whole lot of people.
My guest is Chico Lager, former CEO of Ben & Jerry's. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Chico Lager, former CEO of Ben & Jerry's and author of a new book about the company called Ben & Jerry's, The Inside Scoop. One of the practices of Ben & Jerry's that a lot of people know about is that for a while you had a 5-to-1 pay ratio. In other words, the highest paid person couldn't make more than 5 times the amount that the person who got paid least made at the company. You actually opposed that policy. What were your problems with it? What was the debate about that policy like?
Well, the policy originated back in 1984, 1985, and the idea for it was proposed by Jeff Furman, who was a member of our board of directors. It was modeled after a co-op in Spain in which the managers of the co-op didn't make more than 3 times the people who worked on the factory floor. I agreed very strongly with the concepts that the policy attempted to espouse, which was that people at all levels in the organization contribute to the company's success, and believed very strongly that as the company grew and prospered, everybody throughout the company should share in that success. It shouldn't be just a few people at the top who were getting wealthy. And we were able to put a number of policies into effect that accomplished that. We have a profit-sharing plan that divides up 5% of the pre-tax profits based on length of service, not based on salary or pecking order within the organization. We're a perkless company. All our benefits are even across the board. There's no country club memberships or anything like that. My concern was that as the company grew and became more complex, it was going to need to be able to recruit really qualified senior level managers. And my concern was that a strict ratio was going to be an obstacle to recruiting. And I think over time that proved out to be the case.
So how did you change the ratio?
Well, it got amended to 7-1 after years of debate at the board level back in 1989 or 1990. And recently the board of directors decided to do away with it.
To do away with the ratio altogether?
Completely, yeah. That was a decision that was made at the time that we just decided to recruit a CEO to bring in some more senior-level management expertise.
So what do you think of that? You think that's a good idea?
Hard decision. I think it's a good. It was a good decision. You know, the reality is that Ben & Jerry's doesn't operate in a vacuum, and we've had some searches for senior managers that have gone on for a year, 2 years. The problem is that there aren't that many people who are willing to take a 40 or 50% pay cut to come to work for Ben & Jerry's, particularly when you tell them that if you do a great job, work your 60, 70, 80, 90-hour weeks, and at the end of the year, if we can give our scoopers another 50 cents an hour, we'll give you a $5,000 raise. It just doesn't cut it. And we're not abandoning the concept of link prosperity. We're not abandoning the concept that as the company grows and prospers, everyone should participate in that. We're just saying that we're not going to be held to that strict numerical ratio. And I do think it's a good idea.
How do the employees react to that, the employees who get paid a lot less?
Mixed reaction. You know, for to be honest, a lot of employees were not happy with it. A lot of employees were sorry to see it go and believe that it was an abandonment of a core value. And what I tell them and what I would tell you is that that salary ratio affected only one or two people's salaries. And everybody in the organization will be better off. Everybody in the organization will have higher compensation if we have the best leadership available to us in our senior level positions.
You retired from Ben & Jerry's at the end of 1990. You were still in your 30s, right?
I was 35.
It's a pretty young age to retire from such a successful company. Why did you do it?
Well, I was a little burnt out working 70, 80, 90-hour weeks. I had been doing that at Ben & Jerry's for about 8 years and really doing about the same for the 5 years that I owned the bar before I joined Ben & Jerry's. I always had it in my mind that I would work intensely for a short period of time and then try and enjoy life. You know, working at Ben & Jerry's was really to the exclusion of just about everything else, and it was part of an overall plan. You know, it also talks in the book, you know, pretty openly and honestly that, you know, there were points of friction between Ben and myself and, you know, just really felt that that it was time to go. Remain on the board of directors, you know, maintain my friendship with Ben & Jerry, and I think it was a good point in time to get out.
So what, now that the book is finished, what do you want to do with your time?
I want to be a gardener. I want to hang out, mow my lawn, weed the perennial beds. You know, I enjoyed writing. I would consider doing that again. I work with a few small businesses, do some consulting, still involved with Ben & Jerry's to some extent. I'm on the search committee looking for the new CEO.
You're taking a novel approach to the CEO search. You want to tell us about it?
We are hiring an executive recruiter, which would be the traditional approach that any business would take to hiring a CEO. But we're also holding a contest, the Yo, I'm Your CEO contest, in which people can, in 100 words or less, send in an entry to the company telling us why they should be the CEO. And I've been told that we got about 10,000 entries in the first 5 days. They're coming in all shapes and sizes. Somebody did take a full-page ad out in the New York Times. Somebody else sent us their resume on a giant sheet cake that the board of directors consumed at their last meeting. We've been getting boxes. I think there's been a few people in gorilla suits, the usual things. It seems to be a very entertaining way of getting the word out that we're looking for somebody.
Well, who's stuck with going through the 10,000 applications that have come in?
Well, we've actually hired a bunch of people who were just opening the envelopes and making sure that the rest of our normal mail isn't getting mixed in. And we're going to have teams of employees from throughout the organization kind of going through them, making an initial pass, looking for those really creative ones.
Is this just a PR thing, or do you really expect you might find somebody through the Yo, I'm Your CEO search?
We're hoping and we expect that we will identify some viable candidates that we will then forward to the recruiter. You know, the first prize in the contest is the job. Second prize is membership in the Ice Cream for Life Club, and we're advising people to go for that one.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Jigal Lagar is the former CEO of Ben & Jerry's and author of Ben & Jerry's The Inside Scoop. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Haitian refugees continue to leave that country in record numbers, threatening to overwhelm the U.S. ships in the area. President Clinton talks today with the presidents of Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Mr. Clinton is promising help to the Baltic countries as they try to get the Russian troops out of their countries. Stephen Smith travels to Sarajevo for a report on mental health conditions there, finding lots of depression and disorientation. Also, Kathy Merritt reports from Charlotte, North Carolina, on the investigation into Saturday's air crash.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has been reading new magazines like Wired and Mondo 2000 and has some thoughts on cyberspeak.
Have you looked at these things? Cyberzines, they call themselves, the Vanity Fair and Interview of the Information Age. As best I can figure, the Information Age runs from 18 to 25. Or at least the magazines have a decided MTV look, jazzy fonts on colored backgrounds, text running all over the pictures. It's very engaging, but a little hard to read for somebody of my decade and diopter. I find myself yearning for the austere simplicity of the black and white monitor on my old computer. But maybe that's the point of these magazines, to drive us all online. Clearly something big is afoot. There are echoes of the 60s with all its talk of revolution, how the technology is going to lead to universal empowerment and the end of hierarchy. You might think nothing had changed in the last 30 years, except that now the relevant technology is software engineering instead of pharmacology. It's not surprising to find Timothy Leary on the editorial board of Mondo 2000, having decided to drop in again now that things are once more getting interesting. But the language of the age has nothing to do with the 60s. It's cyberspeak, all those compounds patched together from the truncated syllables of other words. Cyberspace, internet, ethernet, hypertext, vaporware, ubicomp, nanotech, infobon. You think of the fighter planes in the old comic strips, pocketa, 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 pocketa. I have heard the future, and it talks in dactyls. It's a rhythm we've heard before, but not at Woodstock. This is the music of October 1917. It's the way the Bolsheviks consolidated their words, as ruthlessly as they consolidated everything else. Comintern for Communist International, agitprop for agitation propaganda, Komsomol, Komkultur, Sovnarkom, and so on. The words had a willful ugliness, as George Orwell put it, as if to signal a break with bourgeois aesthetics. They spoke of the efficiency of technology. It was literally telegraphic language, the clipped syntax used for communication by wire. The resemblances to cyberspeak are more than accidental. For one thing, current computers constrain the shape of words in some of the same ways that the telegraph did. There are the programming languages that won't accept expressions with extra spaces in them, the operating systems that won't let you use more than 8 letters for a file name so that all your files wind up with titles like taxinfo.txt. And when cyberspeak picks up the pattern, it's as if to say, this is how we're going to talk when we let machines be a party to the conversation. But there are historical connections as well. The terminology of Soviet communism was the model for Orwell's newspeak, words like doublethink and mini-packs, not to mention the name newspeak itself. And that, in turn, was the idiom that William Gibson transformed to make the language of cyberpunk, which took newspeak from gray to noir. It was Gibson who coined cyberspace. It's the sort of word that Big Brother would have used if he'd been a radio evangelist in Raymond Chandler's L.A. Of course, the new cyberspeak doesn't have the dark, oppressive overtones of its predecessors. It's upbeat and hopeful. But then there was a brief moment when the Russian Revolution was light and gay. It was the time of the constructivist avant-garde with their collectives, their peons to bridges and machines, their new forms of theater, not to mention the typographical experiments that prefigured the graphics in Wired and the rest. I'll grant you the comparison has its limits. The digital revolution has produced interesting creative works, but it has yet to turn out a Malevich or a Mayakovsky. For that matter, we should feel a little embarrassed about calling this a revolution at all, at least by contrast to what happened in October of 1917. It's more like a virtual revolution, where everybody gets to lead the charge on the Winter Palace, and nobody actually has to be carried off on a litter. Still, it's a great time to be young and online. And maybe November will come in a little milder this time around.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. He entertains electronic flames at his email address, nunberg@russell.stanford.edu. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlease, Sue Spolin, and Jewel Bracey. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our interns are Abby Beshkin, Philo Holland, and Marcus Tosig. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.